Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco at our new home at 110 Embarcadero, beautiful new building for the Commonwealth Club. I'd also like to welcome our radio and online audiences. And it's my pleasure to introduce Glenn Fukushima, tonight's speaker, on a topic of great interest to anyone who's watching what's going on in Asia. It's called North Korea and the Dynamics of U.S.-South Korean-Japan Cooperation. Mr. Fukushima was a senior fellow, or is a senior fellow, at the Center for American Progress. He's the former president of the American Chamber of Commerce in Japan. He's the former deputy assistant United States trade representative for Japan and China. He has been involved in the relationship of the triangle between the United States, Japan, South Korea, North Korea for decades. And he's here to share his insights at a time that's really crucial. He was very kind and gave you an outline of his speech so you can maybe follow along if you want to in that way. Thank you very much for coming, Mr. Fukushima.
Thanks so much. Well, thank you very much, George, for the very kind introduction. It's great to be back in San Francisco. I should say that I checked the weather channel today and discovered that San Francisco, the high today was 62 degrees. In my home in Washington, D.C., it's 90 degrees, and in Tokyo, where I also have a home, it's 95 degrees. So, especially given the humidity factor, it's great to be back in San Francisco. I should also say that, just by way of background, that my father, when I was a child, was stationed in the Presidio, San Francisco, back in the late 50s. And so I went to school, three schools in San Francisco, the Winfield Scott School near the Presidio, and then the what was at that time called the Hawthorne School on Shotwell, which has since been renamed the Cesar Chavez School. And then the third school was the Sutro School on Funston, right near the Presidio. And then after high school in Los Angeles, I went to College of Stanford, where I met my wife at a student conference. And then after we got married, my wife went to Stanford Business School. So we have a lot of friends in the Stanford and Berkeley area and obviously in San Francisco. So we bought a home here in 2010, and we're planning to eventually retire here, so it's great to be back. For the time being, I'm at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C., working on American policies towards East Asia. I spent about, I'd say, a quarter to a third of my time in Asia. I've been to Asia this year six times. I will be there three more times, primarily Japan, South Korea, China, but this year I also went to New Zealand and Australia. So I do have a sense of what's going on and some of the anxieties and concerns that our allies have in the region, and countries that are not necessarily our allies also have in the region. I've got a lot to compress into about 50 minutes or so, so I prepared an outline, which I'll try to follow pretty closely. What I hope to do is to first talk about some of the issues and factors that concern the interested parties with regard to the DPRK, Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or North Korea. Secondly, the Republic of Korea, or South Korea. Thirdly, Japan. And fourth, the United States. And then I'll talk more specifically about the recent summit on June 12th between President Trump and Chairman Kim. And then talk more generally about how the North Korean issue plays into the greater strategic map and architecture of East Asia. I should also say that this subject is one of great complexity, and I think one needs to understand the history and the background of what's happened over the last couple of centuries, actually, in East Asia to fully understand the relationship among these countries. Also, I think there's a need to understand some of the cultural background as well, because North Korea has a certain way of negotiating, which those who've had experience have written about. It's quite different, I think, from the negotiations that other countries have engaged in with the United States. But also, you know, China, Japan, South Korea also each have their own ways of negotiating, which I certainly experienced when I was at the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative back in the 1980s, and have since seen in the business context when I was working in Asia for 22 years. But all of these, so the history and culture of the region, I think, are very important. And one of the concerns, I think, that many specialists have in watching what's going on now is that, especially in the United States government, there aren't that many people at senior levels who have that kind of history and understanding of the culture. It is encouraging that with regard to some of the more working level people, that there are people in the U.S. government who've had a lot of experience, one person in particular being Sun Kim, currently the U.S. ambassador to the Philippines, who before was a deputy assistant secretary of state in the State Department and had experience working in the six-party talks and so forth. He's originally from Korea, but a U.S. citizen, and he was fortunately asked by Secretary Pompeo, the Secretary of State, to do the preparations for the meeting that took place in Singapore between the president and Chairman Kim. Also, Joseph Yun, who until recently was a deputy assistant secretary of state and was ambassador to Malaysia in the position before his last position, but he was the one who went to North Korea to get the release of Otto Warmbier, the 22-year-old student from University of Virginia, who, after being in North Korea for 17 months, was returned but soon died of illness. And also Andy Kim, the CIA specialist on North Korea, who's accompanied Secretary Pompeo on all of his visits to North and South Korea. And Victor Cha at CSIS, who almost became the U.S. ambassador to South Korea. And Sumi Terry, who also at CSIS. So there are a number of people, and you notice they're all of Korean background, who've had a lot of history and experience. They have language expertise. They know the cultural differences. So it is encouraging that we have some specialists who are assisting the senior people. But at the senior levels, it is discouraging and a bit alarming that we don't have people in the U.S. government who've had a lot of experience and institutional memory and expertise on Asia. Generally, we don't even, for instance, as a footnote, we don't even have in place yet an Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia. Susan Thornton, who was acting in that position, has recently decided to resign, and therefore we don't have an Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia at this point, and it's already almost 2 years into the administration. So I think it's probably the longest time we've not had an Assistant Secretary in place at the State Department. So let me say that, as George mentioned in the introduction, we decided almost a year ago that I would speak about North Korea. A lot has happened since then. March 9th is when President Trump agreed, when he met with Chung Woo-young, the National Security Advisor for South Korea, to meet, at that time, he said, by May, with Chairman Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un. It turned out the meeting was a little delayed. It took place on June 12th instead. But still, that was a historic meeting. Aside from the substance, you can debate the substance, the fact that the President of the United States and the leader of North Korea met, that was a very significant and historic event. I don't think anyone would deny that. Now, getting back to the outline that I'm going to follow, on the DPRK, Democratic Republic, People's Republic of Korea, some of the major issues that I think we are all concerned about is the nuclear weapon development there. In 1994, I still remember, I was based in Tokyo with AT&T, and Secretary Perry at Stanford, who's then the Secretary of Defense, was very much in the thick of trying to decide with President Clinton at that time whether or not the United States should strike North Korea because of its nuclear development. So we came very close to doing that, but the U.S. government decided that it was not the right thing to do, especially given all of the negative consequences that could develop, especially with regard to the retaliation against South Korea, which is very close, the Seoul being very close to the border between the North and the South. So since the mid-90s, the nuclear weapons issue has been at the forefront of the world's attention. Also, chemical biological weapons that the North Koreans have. More recently, missile development, not only short and medium term, but potentially long-term ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles. Another major issue has to do with proliferation. It's not only the North Koreans are developing these weapons, but also there's evidence that they're sharing this with other countries, including in particular countries like Pakistan and some countries in the Middle East. That is a major concern. And aside from all of these weapons of mass destruction, nuclear weapons, chemical, biological warfare, there's obviously the conventional weapons that have been there ever since North Korea was founded in 1948. There's human rights issues. It's one of the most repressive regimes in the world. There's issues of abduction of citizens of other countries, and in particular Japan, which I'll get to. Also, there are a number of prisoners that have been detained by North Korea. POWs, the remains of the war dead. Just recently, there was clearly some advance in the sense that the remains of 50 U.S. service people who served in the Korean War were returned to the United States. We're not yet sure whether these are actually the 50 that are they are claimed to be, but at least this is considered to be a step forward because this issue has been a sticking point between the United States and North Korea for many years. The nature of the North Korean economy is of major concern because although in recent years it appears that the North Korean economy has improved, there has been mass starvation. There's been a tremendous hardship among the people of North Korea as a result of the economic policies that have been pursued by the North, the government. There's also cases of cyber attacks, both to steal intellectual property rights from other countries, companies, but also trying to disrupt activities, economic activities in particular. There's documented crimes, whether it's drugs or counterfeit currency, in order to gain currency for the North Korean government, because it is such an isolated government, and there have been sanctions put in place that have made things rather difficult for the North. They have trying to find all kinds of ways, and very, very creative ways, to try to get the funding necessary to run the country. And so there are all kinds of schemes that have been concocted by the North Korean government that include cooperation with nationals of other countries, in particular China, in order to gain the currency that's necessary. So there's a whole web of criminal activity that is of concern. Also, the relationship between North Korea and China is a very important aspect of this. And I decided in my talk today not to focus so much on China, focus mainly on the three allies, the United States, South Korea, and Japan, and our efforts, because China is another ball of wax altogether. It is such an important and influential party that is kind of in the background of all of what's going on in the current discussions between the U.S. and North Korea and South Korea and Japan. As you know, President Trump, early on in his presidency, placed a great deal of hope and faith that Xi Jinping and the Chinese government would cooperate with the United States in applying pressure on North Korea to get North Korea to get rid of its nuclear development and missile development. In fact, at one point, I remember the president last spring sent out a tweet saying something to the effect that as long as the Chinese are helping us with North Korea, I'm not going to label China a currency manipulator. So in his mind, he was very clearly linking the security dimensions and the potential assistance that he was hoping that he would get from China with regard to North Korea and the economic issue, which this year has surfaced of the U.S. concern about China's trade policies and economic policies. But clearly, China is a major factor here that we need to keep in mind. I did highlight here N, regime survival, because I think that for the North Koreans, above all, the most important factor for them among all of these things is regime survival. 1948 to 1994, for 46 years, Kim Il-sung was the leader of North Korea. For 17 years, from 1994 to 2011, Kim Jong-il was the leader. And now we have the third generation of the dynasty, Kim Jong-un, since 2001, who's been the leader of the country. But clearly, this is a dynasty that wants to stay in power. And regime survival, I think, is the foremost factor in mind. And so I think we need to understand North Korea's behavior based on this fundamental fact, that the bottom line is that they want to maintain and keep this regime intact, and if possible, be able to get the sanctions lifted so that economically North Korea can prosper. And eventually, I think North Korea would like to have reunification under their own terms. And I think that's what North Korea would like. And one of the most important elements of that is to get the United States to agree to not try to engage in changing the regime, to maintain the regime as it is, and hopefully, from the standpoint of North Korea, have a peace treaty between the U.S. and North Korea, the United States and North Korea. Because As you know, the Korean War itself, there's been a ceasefire, so there's a so-called armistice, but there's never actually been the end of the war. And so, in a sense, we still have a continuation of the wartime situation. And you can, I think, understand from the North Korean point of view, being a relatively small country, being bordered by both China and South Korea, and then close by is Japan and then the United States. And so I think you can understand that it does have a certain level of anxiety about what other countries may do in order to end their regime. And so I think they're doing everything they can. And I think they've done actually a pretty good job so far of trying to maintain their regime and to try to dictate the conditions under which they can eventually revive and prosper. So that's North Korea. Secondly, with regard to the Republic of Korea, obviously the Republic of Korea has been a very close and strong ally of the United States over the years. They also have faced the military threat from the North. But I think actually if you visit Seoul or visit South Korea, I think you'll realize that although, yes, there's concern about a military threat from the North, that they've become so used to it that, in a sense, it isn't kind of on everybody's mind as the first thing they think about when they get up in the morning. But increasingly in recent years, with weapons of mass destruction, that is nuclear weapons, with missiles, and with biological warfare, being developed, elements being developed, weapons being developed by the North, there are certain increased concerns in South Korea. There's been a longstanding issue of divided families, those families that were divided as a result of the DMZ, the end of the Korean War. And there are families that haven't been reunited for, say, 50 years between the North and the South. And this is something that under the current regime, or the current government in South Korea, President Moon, there have been some steps, conciliatory steps by the North in order to make it possible for some of these families to be at least have meetings, if not be fully reunited. The issue of U.S. forces in South Korea is of obviously major concern to the North. There are about 30,000, almost 30,000 U.S. forces in the South. And one of the results of the summit meeting between the president and the chairman is that President Trump agreed to suspend for the time being joint military exercises between the South Koreans and the United States, which has been a pretty important part of ensuring the interoperability and cooperation in the military sphere between the U.S. and the South. I think the North Koreans are very happy, very satisfied that this has been lifted for the time being. I think for the South Koreans, and especially for this particular government, the Moon government, unification is really one of the highest of priorities. I think that President Moon sees himself as someone who has the opportunity to, for the first time since the end of World War II and since the end of the Korean War, unify the North and the South. This would be a tremendous undertaking, more difficult actually than the reunification of East and West Germany, because the disparity in wealth and the differences between the North and the South are much more than was the case between the East and West Germany. But this goal or this dream of unification is something that I think President Moon sees this as kind of his mission, as something that he would really like to do and leave in the history books as something that he's been able to accomplish. And I think so far he has. Obviously, there are some opposition party members in the South who are not very optimistic or very supportive of this. But I think overall, he has been able to get many people in South Korea on board in terms of the possibility of this happening, and especially having had the Olympics there and having had that opportunity with the Olympics to have the South Korean athletes to be on the same team with the North, with the North and South working together as one team. All of these events, in addition to the summit meetings that have taken place between President Moon and Chairman Kim, and between President Trump and Chairman Moon, all of these have President Kim and President Trump. All of these have, I think, compared to a year ago, made it much more likely that steps towards unification may be possible. There would clearly be a severe economic burden on South Korea if unification were to take place. But this is, I think, something that the South Koreans are willing to sustain in order to have this kind of a historic unification of the country. There are issues of history that, as I mentioned in the beginning, that impede or make it difficult for especially Japan and North Korea, or Japan and South Korea, to work with each other. And on issues of, for instance, territories as well, there's an island, a set of islands, the Dokdo Islands, as the South Koreans would say, the Takeshima Islands, as the Japanese term it, that is are issues of contention between the South Koreans and the Japanese government. And this issue of comfort women, which has been at issue between Japan and South Korea, remains a major issue, despite the fact that in December of 2015, there was an agreement reached between the then Park government of South Korea and the Obama administration, between the Abe government, Foreign Minister Kishida. And so between Japan and South Korea, the agreement was reached in December of 2015 about this issue of comfort women, which was very actively encouraged by the United States. Secretary Kerry spent a lot of time, and President Obama spent a lot of time, trying to encourage the South Koreans and the Japanese to come to terms on this issue. And so there was considerable optimism, I would say in some quarters euphoria, I recall, in December of 2015 and early 2016 about the fact that this settlement had been reached. However, what happened was that in the spring of 2016, the government of South Korea changed from the Park government to the Moon government, and the Moon government decided that the previously arrived at agreement was not satisfactory, and therefore the agreement has not been sustained. So from the Japanese government's point of view, this was an agreement reached between the two governments, and so even though the government changed in South Korea, the South Koreans should abide by the previous government's agreement, and from the South Korean government's point of view, that was something that the previous government agreed to, and it was a faulty agreement, therefore the terms are not satisfactory. So that continues as an ongoing issue between South Korea and Japan. As I mentioned, President Moon is someone who comes, originally his background is one of being a civil rights attorney, human rights attorney, and I think he's quite progressive in his outlook, and I think that is reflected in his view about this issue of comfort women, but also about his desire to have a substantive advance in the relationship with North Korea, and hopefully, eventually, in the not too distant future, have a unification between the two countries of the North and the South. Now, Japan, as a third party, is also facing the threat of a military attack from the North. There have been many missile launchings that have been done close to and around Japan. For Japan, I think the single most important issue, in addition to the missile and the nuclear issue, is the one of abductees. There have been different people tell you different numbers. I think the minimum number that's been mentioned is 17, and the maximum number is several hundreds of Japanese nationals that have over the years been abducted by the North Korean government for various purposes, including espionage and also being teachers of Japanese to train the North Koreans who could be spies based in Japan. In 2002, as a result of the Pyongyang Declaration between South Korea and Japan, Prime Minister Koizumi visited North Korea, first time a Japanese prime minister visited North Korea, and got the return of five of these abductees. And so that was an advance at that time. But still, the Japanese government claims that there are several dozen more Japanese nationals who have been abducted by the North, and that these should be returned to Japan. The North Koreans at various times have given different answers about either denying that they've been abducted or saying that, yes, maybe some of them did come to North Korea, but they have already died and therefore cannot be returned. But this issue of abductees is one that the current Prime Minister, Prime Minister Abe, has had as one of his major priorities throughout his recent political career. And when the Prime Minister visited President Trump in Washington the week before the President met in June with Chairman Kim in Singapore, one of the main reasons that the Prime Minister of Japan wanted to meet with the President was to reiterate the request of the Japanese government that the President bring up this issue of abductees when he met with the Chairman in South Korea, in Singapore. And the President has said publicly on a number of occasions, I know how important this is for Shinzo Abe, and so I pledged to him that I'm going to raise it. And then at the meeting in Singapore, according to the President, he did mention. Now, there's no mention of what the response was, but anyway, apparently it has been mentioned, and so the President has lived up to the commitment that he made to the Prime Minister of Japan.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
The issue of unification of the Korean Peninsula is a very complicated one for Japan, I think, because on the one hand, most people in Japan would welcome the de-escalation of tensions and the getting rid of a what they consider to be a repressive and terrorist state. On the other hand, if the Korean Peninsula were unified, whether under southern or south or north leadership, that this could create a larger entity on the peninsula, which has, let's say, not a friendly view towards Japan. And so therefore, based on these historical issues I mentioned about the colonization of Korea, the Korean Peninsula, by Japan for 40-odd years, some of the negative memories from that period, and including issues like comfort women and disputes over how territory should be labeled, what their name should be, whether it should be the Sea of Japan or not next to the Korean Peninsula, textbooks, the reinterpretation of various events in the 20th century. These are all issues that I think people in Japan are concerned about if there was unification. And in addition, if there is a peace treaty between Japan and North Korea, this would result in, most likely, Japan paying quite a bit of money to the North, just as Japan paid to the South at the time of the 1965 normalization between South Korea and Japan. So that economic burden is something that Japan would face. The issue of the U.S. forces in Japan, there are currently almost 50,000 U.S. forces in Japan, most of them concentrated in Okinawa, in the southern islands. And this is something that, because Japan, under the Constitution of Japan, where currently Japan spends less than 1% of its GDP on defense, the NATO countries are being encouraged by the president to spend 2%, and recently the president said he wants 4%. But in any case, it's clear that because Japan's economy is the world's third largest, it's a huge economy after the U.S. and China, the absolute amount of spending in Japan is quite high. So depending on who you talk to, the specialist will say Japan has either the fifth largest or the sixth largest military in the world. So it's not that they don't have a military, but if you look at the Constitution of Japan, Article 9 says Japan will not have land, sea, or air forces. So there's a contradiction here somewhere. But in any case, Japan, in part because it doesn't have, because Japan has these constraints on its military as a result of the Constitution, the U.S. forces in Japan are very important for Japan, for its defense. And when you say defense, primarily North Korea and China, because China is increasingly active in the around the Senkaku Islands, and therefore Japan has a real concern about this. And although in Okinawa itself, there is some opposition, considerable opposition, I would say, to the presence of U.S. military, the intensity of the presence, I think, is a real problem. It's not so much the fact that the U.S. military is in Japan, but it's really the intensity, the concentration in Okinawa, which resulted in a number of problems. Therefore, I think that there are... if the U.S. were to withdraw down the military in Japan, this would create some concern in Japan, which probably would result in Japan itself building up its military. And you can debate the pluses and minuses of that, but that would be a significant change in Japan since the end of World War II. So, but this issue of the U.S. forces in Japan really... is related to and is influenced by what happens between the United States and North Korea. And if, for instance, it turns out that there is a real substantive progress in the talks with North Korea, the South Koreans and the United States may agree that perhaps it's worthwhile to draw down, to reduce some of the U.S. forces in the South. And it could argue for the United States could, under certain scenarios, decide that the situation in Northeast Asia has become so stable that it's not necessary to have such a huge military presence by the United States in the region. And as you know, Mr. Trump, President Trump is very concerned about cutting costs. And so that's certainly an element that would enter into his thoughts, I think. So issues of history and territories, as I mentioned, and comfort women are all the issues that I already mentioned with regard to the relation between South Korea and Japan. China, as I mentioned, is obviously a very important factor in the whole North Korea situation. But beyond that, I think the relation between Japan and China is also one that has a very complicated and long history. Much of it very positive, some of it conflictual. And so this is also, the China factor is one that cannot be ignored in thinking about the situation in Northeast Asia. Japan and Prime Minister Abe have been among the most avid, strongest supporters of maximum pressure, maximum sanctions on North Korea. I think Prime Minister Abe and the Japanese leadership believe that North Korea in the past has reached certain agreements with the international community that it has violated, and therefore the only way that North Korea will change its behavior is if there is very strong action by other countries, especially in imposing sanctions. And so I think at this point, because President Trump has drawn back a bit, and has not been using the term maximum sanctions, maximum pressure, I think at this point Japan may actually be out ahead in terms of the country that is most desirous of having both the United Nations and individual countries impose severe sanctions on the North. So I'm going to switch to page 2 and go to the United States. As I mentioned before, the legacy of the Korean War, and in particular the fact that it is an armistice, not a peace treaty, that's been signed, means that this is an ongoing issue diplomatically between the United States and North Korea. And the issue of the POWs, the remains of the war dead, is still a live issue. Weapons of mass destruction are, as I've highlighted here, probably the most important issue as far as the United States is concerned at this point with regard to North Korea and the issue of proliferation. And this all impinges on the issue of the presence of U.S. forces in the South and also in Japan. China, as I've mentioned before, is an important factor. And from the U.S. point of view, and I think that many of the Northeast Asia specialists in the United States, there are debates among the specialists as to how capable and how willing China is in trying to resolve this issue in North Korea of the nuclear weapons and the missiles. But I think most observers, most specialists agree that it is China does not see it in its interest to have the North Korean regime collapse, because that would result in having on its border a unfriendly government, that is the South Korean government, and also it could result in considerable issues of immigration and refugees if the regime in North Korea were to collapse suddenly. Clearly, the issue of human rights is something that the United States has long been concerned about with regard to North Korea, although I would have to say that in this particular, the U.S. particular administration, this is an issue that is of concern to various NGOs and MPOs, probably of less concern to the U.S. government, because the president himself has not, in any of his statements about North Korea, focused on human rights as a central concern of the administration. Clearly, cyber attacks, I think a lot of attention now is going to the cyber attacks and the Russian influence in the 2016, potential 2018 elections in the United States. But clearly, the United States is concerned about cyber attacks by the North in the United States as well as other countries. The issues of crime, drug, counterfeit money, and so forth are all part of the concern, and therefore the United States has been a strong advocate with the United Nations of imposing sanctions to try to change behavior in North Korea. Now, President Donald Trump, I think different people have different interpretations of why he agreed suddenly, all of a sudden, with surprising the world on March 9th, that he would meet with the chairman of North Korea. I guess some people have a very simple explanation, is that he's the president who likes to do what no other president has done in the past. And this was certainly something that he could claim he did that no other president has done in the past. I think most other presidents would have required some kind of lower level discussions and negotiations leading up to the meeting between the two heads of state. I actually happened to work for a couple of years on Hillary Clinton's Asia Policy Working Group, and during the run-up to the 2016 election, it was very clear among these specialists on Asia who were advising Secretary Clinton that North Korea was a very high priority. And I think that even if a Clinton administration had come into office, there would have been some very early overtures to North Korea and having discussions, but on the working level, with North Korea that could eventually have perhaps led to a head of state meeting, but I think much later down the road. You know, I think some people will say that they're different. Now, moving now to the U.S. DPRK specifically and the Singapore summit between on June 12th between the president and the chairman, I think you can find a lot of different interpretations and evaluations of this meeting. I would say that in Washington, D.C., among those who are specialists on Northeast Asia, I would say that the marks given to this meeting are not high. But there are those who argue that this was a historic event, never been done before, and if you want to move things forward, you have to do it in kind of a leap rather than just incremental stages. And from that point of view, this was a leap. And so, and I think from the motivation point of view, from the standpoint of the North, certainly Kim Jong-un has been wanting, as well as his father and grandfather have been wanting for decades, to get the recognition of the United States and to have a meeting with the President of the United States. So certainly that was a major achievement as far as the North was concerned. Also, as I mentioned, the President agreed to suspend for the time being the joint military exercises between the South and the United States. So that was another achievement. And then to have this world attention given to Kim Jong-un and having him seen on television, on CNN, Fox News, and BBC and everywhere, like, you know, a normal leader of a country. And I think he got tremendous public exposure, and I think he actually gained quite a bit of credibility and profile, heightened profile as a result of that meeting. What the United States got is less certain. Certainly did not get the CVID, the complete, verifiable, irreversible dismantlement of nuclear weapons and missiles in North Korea, which I think the specialists were hoping that the president would try to get a commitment from the chairman on. But clearly this didn't happen. I think most observers believe that the agreement that was reached in Singapore on June 12th was a step back from the 2005 joint statement between the United States and North Korea. And in many ways, the pacing and the sequencing of events leading up to the meeting on June 12th, as well as since then, reflect that North Korea is in the driver's seat. For instance, I think from the North Korean point of view, they want a normalization of bilateral relations between the United States and North Korea first, followed by a peace treaty, followed by denuclearization. And even denuclearization, it's not clear what that means. The definition of denuclearization, depending on who you talk to, is completely different. And I think from the North's point of view, when they say denuclearization, they mean getting rid of nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula. So what they mean is the United States, South Korea, North Korea, you know, everybody, nobody has nuclear weapons. That would be what denuclearization is. And the timing for this is something that is not at all clear. And so the fact that this meeting took place, the U.S. actually gave up a number of things and really did not gain very much, is of concern. Now, the president has expressed his view that the chairman is an honorable person, that he will live up to his commitments. And since then, there have been several attempts by Secretary Pompeo to meet either with Kim or Ri Yong-ho, who is the Secretary of State, the Foreign Minister of North Korea. And just recently, just last weekend in Singapore, there was a meeting of the ASEAN countries hosted by Singapore. And there, the Japanese Foreign Minister, Taro Kono, also met with Ri Yong-ho, the North Korean Foreign Minister. But apparently there was nothing substantive that was seen in terms of advancing this meeting, the issues. There, according to an interview that John Bolton had with Fox News earlier today, the president gave Secretary Pompeo a letter to give to President to give to the North Korean Foreign Minister for Chairman Kim, and it appears that there may be another summit meeting between the president and the chairman before too long. The UN General Assembly meeting in September in New York is pointed to as one potential time when the such a meeting could take place. But as it looks now, when the two leaders meet, when the president and the chairman meet, they smile, they shake hands, they seem to have some level of chemistry. But then after that meeting ends, and when it comes to the working level people, there seems to be very little progress. So we don't have a good sense yet as to whether this is going to continue or whether there are actually going to be some significant steps forward. The most of the indications from the U.S. Security specialists is that North Korea is not stopping its development of missiles and of nuclear weapons, and therefore the skeptics at this point are pointing this out. It is important, obviously, for the U.S. and the ROK and Japan to engage in cooperation, in part because from the North Koreans' point of view, they believe that they have China as its ally, supporting it. And obviously, the Chinese have their own conditions for what they want out of all this. But Chairman Kim has been to China several times to meet with Chinese leaders. He's also met with Russian leaders, and so there is, I wouldn't say a proxy, but there's a kind of discussion going on where the United States, South Korea, and Japan on the one hand, and China, Russia, and North Korea on the other are kind of engaging in, I think, strategic discussions about the future of the security regime in Northeast Asia. So I have only a few minutes left, so let me just try to put this in the broader context of Northeast Asia. I think one of the concerns that observers of the region have is that because the U.S. operates on an election cycle of 2 years, midterm elections and 4 years of presidential election, and our leaders tend to think in relatively short time spans, in Asia, we have in China, Xi Jinping, who recently changed the rules so that he could stay in power for indefinite future. We're not likely to see elections in North Korea soon. So you can, unless something happens to Kim Jong-un, you know, his grandfather lasted for 46 years. His father lasted for 17 years. And so we're not going to likely to see a change there. And in Japan, Prime Minister Abe has been in office now for 6 years plus 1 year that he served before in 2006-2007. So he got the rules changed for the LDP, Liberal Democratic Party. So now the LDP allows for three-term prime ministers rather than two three-year term prime ministers. That means that if he wins re-election in September of this year in the LDP for the presidency of the LDP, he could serve another 3 years as prime minister and stay in power until 2021, which means that that's 3 plus 3 plus 3 plus 1, so 10 years. So Prime Minister Abe will end up being, if he succeeds, the longest serving prime minister in Japanese history. Because in 1885, Japan instituted the prime ministerial system. There's been no prime minister who served that long. So you have Japan, 10 years. You have North Korea, indefinite. You have China, indefinite, the leaders. South Korea, I don't know. But you've got all these countries in Asia that think not only do they either not have elections or even have elections, they kind of like incumbents. And so if you compare that with the United States, you know, it's the people in Northeast Asia are thinking of this as a long-term game. It's a long-term strategy. And it's not like 1 or 2 or 3 months or even 1 or 2 or 3 years. It's a long-term strategy of where North Korea wants to be in Northeast Asia, where China wants to see in the region, what Japan wants to see in the region. And I think that that is a real concern, that on the U.S. side, not only is there not a lot of expertise or history, knowledge, historical memory, historical institutional memory on the senior levels, but also that the time spans that we're looking at from the U.S. perspective is so short. During the Obama administration, there was a so-called Asia pivot, and I don't have time to go into this, so I just listed here the six elements of the Asia pivot when Secretary Clinton was Secretary of State. But I think that that provided a framework for the United States to engage with Asia, and Asia being the fastest growing region in the world economically, I think it was appropriate for the administration to focus renewed and strengthened attention to Asia. Unfortunately, I think I would be the first to admit that under President Obama, this notion of strategic patience with North Korea didn't work. It was basically trying to push North Korea put it off, basically kind of procrastinate and not deal with the problem. And in the meantime, it allowed North Korea to develop even more than it had in the past its nuclear and missile capabilities. So I think in retrospect, the strategic patience approach did not work. And I think there should have been measures taken earlier in the administration to deal with North Korea. Now, the Trump administration has pretty much abandoned this whole notion of an Asia pivot. They certainly have abandoned the notion of multilateral commitments because with the withdrawal from the TPP, for instance, Trans-Pacific Partnership, just a few days after the president assumed power as president. And I think there's a tendency for the administration to not value alliance relationships, especially when it comes to multilateral arrangements, whether it's NATO or TTIP, APEC, ASEAN, and so forth. And also, as I mentioned, number six here, promotion of democracy and human rights has kind of dropped off the agenda for this administration. But the administration has, and this was articulated by the president when he visited the region in November and gave a speech at the CEO's conference in Da Nang in Vietnam, this notion of a free and open Indo-Pacific. And the notion is that the United States, Japan, India and Australia would be working in cooperation, especially on the military security side. Each of these countries seems to have a slightly different notion of what this all means. And in fact, when I was in Australia in April, I was told by the Australians that they are currently in the process of talking with their American counterparts to figure out exactly what all of this means and trying to coordinate their positions on this. But I think it is safe to say that this issue of North Korea will remain as a problem for many years to come, because this notion of denuclearization is not a simple one that can be accomplished in a matter of weeks or even months. It's going to take a lot of time, expertise, resources, and attention to get done. So I'm certainly hopeful that we will make advances. But in conclusion, I'd just like to say that although there's going to be a lot of media coverage and a lot of attention over the next several months to this, and maybe even years to this issue of North Korea, I think we really need to focus on the content of these discussions, and in particular, the meeting on June 12th, I think, needs to be scrutinized and analyzed based on the content of what was accomplished, but also the process. Are we devoting the necessary resources and the expertise to getting this done? And number three, the time span in getting it done, because I think too often the U.S. side thinks in very short time spans, and the Asians, the Northeast Asians, are thinking this in a much longer strategic time span. And so let me, I think I probably raised more questions than I've answered, but let me close my comments here and ask if there might be some questions or comments. Thanks very much.
So I'd like to remind our audience that they're listening to Glenn Fukushima speaking about North Korea and the U.S.-Japan-Korea cooperation in the area, and the problems of their long-term vision versus our ADD. So we will start with...
When you speak of unification, you concentrated on the economic problems, but there's also what might be somewhere between a political and an emotional problem, which is the Kim Dynasty, which is basically concerned primarily with its own survival, both physical survival and survival as a power. Is it possible to speak of unification between that intense focus and the South Koreans?
I think the short answer is no. I think that if the Kim Dynasty continues the way it has been, I think it would be impossible to have reunification. I think reunification is based on the assumption that there will be some change in the North Korean regime. And, I mean, it doesn't have to be a full-fledged democracy overnight, but I think there would have to be some change in the North Korean regime in order to make it possible for reunification to happen. So I don't think anyone has, except maybe the North, has any illusions that the current regime could stay in power and still have realization of unification in the way that the South Koreans or the Americans or the Japanese would like. So there has to be some change in the North. And the thing is that, some of the specialists, not only in the United States but elsewhere, have been saying for the last 20, 30 years, this regime is unsustainable. It's got so much internal contradiction, so much internal tensions. There's so much poverty. There's so much suppression. There's so many political prisoners that it has to collapse. And so they've been saying that for the last 20 or 30 years, but it hasn't collapsed. So I think in many ways it's kind of defied the experts. But I mean, I think it is in part the fact that the North Koreans have been very, I would say, resourceful in enlisting the assistance of especially China in having its survival. And also, I think, manipulating the international system to try and making pledges at certain times and then having the sanctions released and then benefiting from that and getting, food and other products and then using those for means other than what they were intended. So I think they've been very, very skillful in doing that. But to answer your question, I don't think that there could be a unification with the Kim Dynasty the way it is now.
Yes, I have two questions that illustrates opposite sides of this issue. First question concerns the return of the remains of alleged U.S. military personnel.
Right.
It is my understanding that North Korea has returned some remains in the past,
yes.
Not United States, but maybe British or something.
Right.
And they were never particularly identified as any individuals. In fact, at least one of them wasn't even human remains. It was animal
right.
remains.
That's right.
And is there? So my question is there any reason to believe that this situation is different?
Mm.
I have heard one thing, only one bit of information, and that is that there was one set of dog tags, and they're not even sure that those are U.S. military dog tags.
Okay.
So that's one question. The other question is a recent thing of a defection to South Korea of some workers who were working in the northeast area of China, just across the border, which North Korea uses for getting currency. And there were 14 waitresses and one kind of functionary who was in charge of them. Now they're in South Korea. They're all saying that they were misled. They didn't get what they were expecting to get. And so it's not clear whether the waitresses in particular are now afraid that their families in North Korea are now going to get punished. But one thing it does clearly indicate to me is that Moon Jae-in, for all his talk about reunification or whatever, doesn't even have control over his own intelligence agency, which was obviously behind this whole thing. Now, I haven't seen any articles on this thing, which has been going on since April, except in the New York Times. So if you could enlighten us on those two issues, that would be very good.
Thank you. On the first issue of the return of the remains, it is true that the North Koreans have in the past, on several occasions, returned what was alleged to be remains. And after investigations, I think with DNA testing and so forth, it was found that they were not what they were claimed to be. And as you say, in one case, it wasn't even human remains. So on this time as well, the 50 service people, I think they're all service men, who allegedly their remains were returned, I think it's going to take several months for the U.S. to do the testing to verify whether what has been claimed is true or not. And, you know, the skeptics say this is just a delaying tactic by the North. You know, they know exactly what they're doing, and they're doing what they did in the past, and so don't expect anything significant. So, but then there are, you know, obviously we want to hope for the best, and I think that the there are some who say, well, you know, let's give them time, and, you know, maybe it is the case that Kim Jong-un feels that as a result of the meeting with the president that he needs to fess up and needs to, you know, abide by what he committed to. So perhaps this really is the real deal. Maybe it is different from the past. So I think we're going to have to see, based on those tests, what is revealed. With regard to your second question, I am not familiar with, I've been on vacation for a while, so I haven't been reading the New York Times every day. So I missed that particular article. But it is the case that there are, I'd say, probably once every few months, cases of defections of North Koreans to the South. And there are, I think about 2 years, 3 years ago, it was a very celebrated case of the DCM, Deputy Chief of Mission, of I think it was the London embassy or the London office, where the North Korea, where a very senior level official of North Korea defected, and he's been giving a lot of interviews in the South and also in Japan, maybe here in the United States as well. So you know, it is the case that there are defections now. Defections are obviously, you know, very complicated affairs, because often these people have family members back in the North. And also, I think it's been documented in the past that some of the defections actually ended up not being defections, that they were actually became double agents. And and so, you know, these are very complicated things. And this particular case, I'm not aware. But I guess I would venture to say that it's when the situation in the North, I think, especially economically, becomes more dire, that we're likely to see more defections. And I think in the recent couple of years, I think the economy actually has done better in North Korea than many had anticipated. And I think the number of defections from the North has kind of stabilized. There isn't kind of a sharp increase right now in the defections. But I think if we'd see a significant increase in defections, I think that would be one indication of how the economic situation in the North is turning for the worse.
Does your organization, the Center for American Progress, have a thesis, published or otherwise, as to what the U.S. ought to do in the Korean Peninsula?
The short answer is no. Center for American Progress is a think tank that has researchers doing research on a wide range of topics. I would say that it has traditionally been more on domestic policy, and we have not to date issued a report on what needs to be done with regard to the North. Now, there are many other think tanks in Washington that have researchers who've had especially government experience, whether CSIS with Victor Cha or Carnegie, or Brookings, or others, where they have East Asian specialists who have certainly written articles and given commentary. I'm not aware that there's any clear kind of blueprint of what the U.S. ought to be doing that's been issued by these think tanks. But I think if you just, you know, check on the internet, North Korea, Washington think tanks, I think you'll probably come up with at least 20 or 30 specialists on the Korean Peninsula, Council on Foreign Relations, Scott Snyder at Council on Foreign Relations, and others, who will give their analysis of what's going on, and in some cases give recommendations, prescriptions of what ought to be done.
Yeah. You mentioned before the difficulties between negotiations or any communications really between the two Koreas and Japan. You also mentioned the constraints that Article 9 imposes on the Japanese, which is viewed very positively by some countries in the region given the historic context. Yet the current Japanese Prime Minister has made amending that a priority of his, in at least on his word. And his party and its allies have the numbers necessary to begin the amendment process in their country.
Yep.
So with that in mind, what could any attempts to amend that constitution have with regards to relations between those three countries, let alone the United States and China, let alone any actual success in doing so?
Right. Okay, so this issue of constitutional reform is an issue that has been around for ever since 1947, when the Constitution was revised in Japan by the United States. So it's true that the Prime Minister has publicly stated that revising the Constitution is among his highest priorities. If he is reelected for the three-year term that I mentioned, it's likely that he will try to get the Constitution revised. However, although, as you point out, in the upper house and lower house of the Diet, he may have the votes necessary to get it done. It has to go through a national referendum. And the national referendum probably would result in rejecting a change, especially when it comes to Article 9. I think that the Japanese public at this point is still not ready to significantly change Japan's Article 9. I also think that one factor that needs to keep in mind is what happens in the international environment. The only scenario right now that I can personally see the possibility of Article 9 being changed in the next few years is if the North Korean situation persists and intensifies and gets worse from the Japanese point of view. Number two, relations between South Korea and Japan continue without improving. If China increases its attempt to claim the Senkaku Islands, and number four, the U.S. withdraws troops from Japan and or otherwise weakens the credibility of the U.S. Guarantee for Japan's security, if those factors happen, then I think that there will be foundation laid for to make the argument that we cannot any longer rely on the United States, that the countries around Japan are increasingly hostile and building their military, and China certainly is. Therefore, the only option for Japan is to increase its military significantly, and the way to do that would be to revise the Constitution. So that I will not rule that out as a probability, but at this point I would say it's less than a 10% probability. So I don't anticipate that the Constitution will be revised soon.
Time for one last question.
You had mentioned the agreement between Korea and Japan concerning the comfort women.
Yes.
Could you elaborate on that, what the agreement was?
Okay. So let me try to remember the details. actually, I was in South Korea in Seoul in February of 2016, 3 months after that agreement was reached. And trying to remember, it's a very complicated issue where the Japanese had created an Asian Women's Fund in order to collect funding from individual Japanese to give compensation to the women who had been captured or enslaved, you know, as sex slaves during World War II. And so there's a lot of controversy between Japan and South Korea about the numbers of women and also the condition under which those women were forced into becoming sex slaves. And so the Park government at that time of South Korea and the Abe government had negotiations, and they came to an agreement under which Japan would pay, the Japanese government would pay a certain fund to the South Koreans. They would create a foundation, and from that fund, they would also give compensation to the remaining, I think at that time, about 46 women who were still alive from that period. And the Foreign Minister Kishida of Japan and the South Korean Foreign Minister had a press conference in Seoul in December of 2015 announcing this agreement. And it had a number of other elements to it, in addition to the Japanese government providing the funding and compensation being given to the women. There had, I think there was, foundation was create some kind of educational fund, and to and also there, you know, there was an apology given by the Prime Minister of Japan for this system that the Japanese had had. And so at that time, there was considerable optimism that finally, after many, many years of controversy, this issue would be laid to rest. And especially President Obama, on several occasions, was very aggressive in getting Prime Minister Abe and President Park together. And there was some public, there was a disarmament meeting in, I think it was in Geneva or someplace in Europe, maybe it was Brussels, where actually President Obama sat down these two leaders and basically kind of forced them into a meeting. And finally, after months of effort, with Secretary Kerry also doing his part, there was an agreement reached. And I remember when that agreement was announced that Secretary Kerry came out with a very positive statement praising the fact that the two governments had come to this agreement. But as I mentioned, because President Park was impeached and removed from office, and President Moon came into office, and President Moon, being a more progressive kind of a social justice person who had been a civil rights attorney, a human rights attorney, he had a great deal of personal sympathy for these women, for the comfort women, met with them personally, and they did an investigation. They had a commission in South Korea to investigate this agreement. And they came to the conclusion that it was faulty because the South Korean government, the previous South Korean government, had not fully taken into account the views of the women victims. And so based on that, the Moon government decided that this was a faulty agreement. And the other part of this agreement, which actually wasn't written in the agreement, but it was something that the Japanese side assumed and had some indication from South Korea that it could happen is that several years ago, a statue was built in front of the Japanese embassy in South Korea, in Seoul, of a girl who symbolized this comfort women issue. And the Japanese government had, ever since then, demanded that that statue be removed. And the South Korean government's position was, well, that's not our response because we didn't build it. It was some NGO, NPO, and it's really not our control. You know, they did what they had to do. So you can't force us, you can't tell us that we have to force them to remove the statue. But in the process of coming to this agreement in December 2015, the Japanese side apparently had gotten some indication from the South Korean government that they would do everything they could possible in order to persuade the NGO to remove the statue. But that never happened. So the statue still remains. And not only does the statue still remain, another statue was built in Busan, close to the Japanese consulate there. That led Prime Minister Abe to withdraw from both Seoul, the U.S. Japanese ambassador, Mr. Nagamine, and from Busan, the Japanese consul general there, to Japan for several months in protest. So that's where things stand now. And so, unfortunately, if the government of South Korea had not changed, I think that agreement would still be in place. Because of the change of the government, and not only was a change of government, but the orientation of the government was a very different orientation. I mean, the previous government was a more conservative government. And so that resulted in the current government basically saying that that agreement was faulty and should not be abided by.
And there's also a statue. Yeah. There's also a statue that went up in San Francisco.
Yeah, there's a long story behind that one too.
Yeah, and we had a program on that about a year and a half ago. If you would like to listen to that in detail, that's on our podcast. So thank you very much, Mr.
Okay.
Fukushima.
Thank you very much.
Dealing with a very complex subject. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 116th year of Inland Discussion. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you.